from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, in his new book, The Future of the Mind, theoretical physicist Michio Kaku explores how the next century of scientific innovation will expand the brain's abilities. He'll join us to discuss the latest in neurological research, how the brain resembles a corporation, and the fantastic inventions that will change everything from entertainment to spying. Join us for Forum next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And we welcome Michio Kaku to the program in this morning's opening hour, a theoretical physicist. He's co-founder of string theory and also professor of theoretical physics at the City College and City University of New York. He's also the author of Hyperspace, Beyond Einstein, Physics of the Impossible, and Physics of the Future, as well as having been host of several television specials and of a national science radio show. And recently, he published a book called The Future of the Mind, and it's a book all about the scientific quest to understand, enhance, and give greater power to the mind. He joins us in studio for this morning's opening Forum Hour. Good to have you with us once again. Welcome.
Glad to be on the show.
I guess I want to really get into your new book, which I think is fascinating. It's all kinds of futuristic things that fascinate us. Maybe we can talk a little bit about gravity, too, since we're going to be talking about the Academy Awards in the next hour. But also, thought maybe we began by talking about Fukushima. Last time you were on, we had you on by ISDN, and you were kind of updating us, and I know you've kept current with it. How do things stand from your perspective?
Well, think of someone at the edge of a building about to fall off, but hanging on by his fingernails. That's the Fukushima disaster right now. You realize that we have three melted cores. We don't know what they look like. We have yet to put a robot in to photograph these melted cores. We have hundreds of tons of radioactive water. The utility has now admitted that much of that is washing into the ocean, getting into the food chain. And we're talking about cesium-137 with a half-life of 30 years, meaning that it's radioactive for perhaps 300 years, getting into the food chain slowly. And so people in Tokyo sometimes have to go with a Geiger counter when they go vegetable shopping. And it's this horrendous situation that's going to cost billions of dollars in about 40 years. It'll take about 40 years to decommission these reactors.
I thought the robots would be ready to go. I mean, how come they haven't put them in?
No, you see, Hollywood has brainwashed us in thinking that we're going to have robots that are smarter than us. And
well, your book is also making us think about, I mean, your new book is making us think about how advanced we're going to be in robotics, too.
Yeah, but not artificial automatons. It turns out the brain is much more sophisticated than we thought. Thinking robots that can turn a screw and can operate a hammer are beyond all abilities of our scientists. The Pentagon is now spending $1 million on a crash program to create a robot that can turn screws, operate a hammer, and repair a damaged nuclear power plant. This is the U.S. Pentagon making this a priority now.
Well, since you talk about Hollywood, and I know you like to give them slack, but gravity, and we're going to be talking about the Academy Awards in the next hour with the whole panel. The science in there has been sort of exploded by astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's head of New York's planetarium. He took to Twitter and questioned the logic of what he called the future of physics as it's presented here. Let me just give some of these tweets that he threw out there. Why Bullock, a medical doctor, is servicing the Hubble Space Telescope? How Hubble and a Chinese space station are all in sight lines of one another? When Clooney releases Bullock's tether, he drifts away, and zero-G, a single tug, brings them together. And why Bullock's hair and otherwise convincing zero-G scenes did not float freely on her head? Well, because it's Hollywood, right?
That's right. No, look, I love science fiction movies. I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker for special effects. And realize that whole generations of young people become scientists because they watch Flash Gordon and Star Wars as a child. Edwin Hubble, the greatest astronomer who ever lived, perhaps besides Galileo, became an astronomer because he read Jules Verne as a child. He was doomed to become a country lawyer. Remember Jules Verne? Quit his job as a country lawyer and went to the University of Chicago, got a PhD in astronomy, and discovered the expanding universe, which led to the Big Bang Theory. So, Neil, I respect you. I had dinner with you a few years ago, but hey, give me a break.
Well, talk about science fiction. I think the Foundation Trilogy has been of a major influence in your life. I know that. And where did physics and neuroscience suddenly come together for you?
Well, you know, when I was a child, I used to love doing experiments on telepathy, mind reading, on telekinesis, moving objects with your mind. I dreamed about uploading memories, recording memories, maybe even photographing a dream. Well, hey, all that's bunk. You can't do it. Let me tell you right now. I realized that there may be telepaths who walk the surface of the Earth, but I wasn't one of them. But now I'm a physicist. We can do all of the above. Photographing a dream, recording memories, moving objects with your mind, mind reading, these are things which we now do in the laboratory. So for me, it's a dream come true.
And all of these things you see as really not only being likely in the future, but or possible in the future, but frankly, predictably part of our future.
That's right, because there's an enormous amount of interest to cure mental illness, to alleviate the suffering of people with Alzheimer's disease, and to alleviate the suffering of people who are totally paralyzed. For example, think of Alzheimer's disease. We can now upload a memory into a mouse. And we will soon upload a memory into a chimpanzee and eventually into Alzheimer's patients with a brain pacemaker so that Alzheimer's patients will know who they are, who their children are, where they live, where they left their keys. And this is going to revolutionize the way we view memory. And even beyond that, who knows, maybe upload a vacation that you never had.
I want to talk with you about some of these Brave New World insights that you have. But I have to tell you, first of all, that recently I had an MRI. I was having terrible headaches and turned out to be just what I thought it might be, which was a sinus headache. But the fact of the matter is you're talking about having MRIs really in the size of a cell phone. When I got my report back from my MRI and my doctor said, don't worry about this. This will be the first thing in your report. It says your brain is atrophying.
Well, says, comforting.
Just a part of aging. Yeah, right. I mean, you see that brain atrophying. It really gives you a lot of... But, you know, I'm reading your book and I'm thinking, well, we got cognition pills off in the future too. And not only that, but the brain is really not so much like a computer as we thought. It's like, it turns out, a big corporation, Citizens United notwithstanding.
Yes, think of the unconscious mind that Sigmund Freud talked about. We can actually show that the bulk of the brain's activity is unconscious, just like a large corporation CEO does not have to know what's happening throughout the entire corporation. And emotions. Emotions are automatic responses to emergency situations that the CEO does not have to know about. So corporations also have emotions. They also have to have rapid-fire responses that the CEO doesn't have to know about. And so many of the things that Freud talked about that were totally unprovable can now be demonstrated using MRI scans. The ego, the superego, the libido, yes, we can actually photograph them in the living brain now.
Oh, I'd be surprised at what the photographing of libidos might turn out to be. Michio Kaku is with us. His new book is called The Future of the Mind. But then most people think telepathy, telekinesis, cognition pills, these things are just the things of science fiction.
Nope. They're things that we can do in the laboratory today. Next time you see my colleague Stephen Hawking on television, look at his right glass. He's lost control of his fingers. He's totally paralyzed. But we put a chip in his right glass so that it picks up radio from his brain, deciphers it so that he can operate a laptop computer. We can now hook up people who have strokes, massive strokes, or injuries in Iraq and Afghanistan, hook their brain up to a mechanical arm, next a mechanical leg, and then an exoskeleton. In fact, at the next Brazilian International Soccer Games, scientists at Duke University hope to take someone who's totally paralyzed, outfit him with an exoskeleton so that he will walk up to the podium and start the Brazilian soccer games. That is an attainable goal. The goal is to have mobility for people who are paralyzed because of strokes, football accidents, war, or what have you.
I want to come back to some of these futuristic neuroscience and physics together notions that you have in the book. But since you mentioned Hawking and his total paralysis, nevertheless, right glass with that sensor in it, picking up radio waves, what was your response when, let me frame this another way. Hawking said that he was an agnostic, but then he became, he was an atheist, an agnostic, but then he became an atheist when he learned that, and I mentioned this because, again, when Neil deGrasse Tyson was on, we were talking about atheism and agnosticism, he takes a pretty strong atheist line. But Hawking said he became an atheist when he learned that gravity had preceded the Big Bang. Now, I don't know how that actually figures, but how does that figure in Michio Kaku's mind?
Well, see, Stephen Hawking is what we call a semi-classical physicist, that he's not fully quantum mechanical. Therefore, he thinks that time began with the instant of the Big Bang. There was nothing before the Big Bang, no God, no angels, no saints, and then, boom, all of a sudden we had the Big Bang. Well, I don't believe that. You see, I'm a quantum physicist. I'm a string theorist. I'm the co-founder of string field theory, one of the main branches of string theory. And string theory goes before the Big Bang. Einstein gives us a picture that the universe is a soap bubble that's slowly expanding. That's the Big Bang theory. String theory says that there are other bubbles out there. And these other bubbles can sometimes bump into each other, like in a bubble bath, or split apart. And that is the Big Bang.
And you've got all these multiverses and parallel universes and all
exactly.
the rest of that sort of thing. But it may be just as hypothetical as some of these futuristic notions that we have in terms of what, because if you look at a lot of these things skeptically, you say, telekinesis? You know, come on.
No, come on. We come on to the laboratories because we will show you how the mind can energize computers, power supplies, and move objects. In fact, in the future, when you walk into a room, you'll no longer look for the mouse or the portal. You'll simply mentally communicate with objects in the room, turn on the lights, the thermostat, the computer, movies, download any piece of information, drive your car mentally. In fact, Apple Computer is even thinking of redesigning the computer so that people can simply put on a headband and communicate with the computer directly. In the future, we could even have a brain net. The internet might be replaced by a brain net where memories and emotions are sent right over the internet lines. Teenagers will love it because they'll be able to, on Facebook, upload the first memory of their first kiss, their first date, some kind of hot encounter with a cute kid. I mean, these are things that young kids are going to gravitate toward, and it's not so far away. We can now record memories.
Well, in fact, there's all this scanning technology with pattern recognition software that you write about, EEG scans, and their crude approximations of people's thoughts simply put on a helmet, right? Like Jack Gallant has. He's been on this program talking about this from Berkeley.
That's right. In fact, I visited his laboratory, and it's amazing that he can actually photograph a thought. Now, even I thought this was outside the realm of physics, but they do it now at the University of California, Berkeley, where I got my PhD years ago at the Rad Lab. And the way they do it is they put a person in an MRI machine, which then converts electrical activity to 30,000 dots. It's like a Christmas tree of 30,000 dots shaped like a human brain. And then Jack has gotten a software program that takes this mass of 30,000 dots and creates a picture. And then I talked to one of the postdocs there, and he said that he fell asleep. He fell asleep in this machine, and of course, the MRI machine just kept on chugging away, analyzing all his neural activity and created a picture of a dream. One day, you may wake up and push the play button and watch the dream you had the previous night.
This is like that movie Inception with Leonardo DiCaprio, right? We're going to be able to go in our dreams or, I mean,
that's right.
Plausibly.
That's right. And lucid dreaming, that is being conscious while you are dreaming, was once thought to be an old wives' tale, but we've now proven it. At Max Planck Institute in Germany, they took a man who claimed that he can alter his dreams, put it on an MRI scan, and sure enough, on command, he could alter his dreams. And so the lore of dreaming can either be verified or thrown out the window because we now have the ability to look into dreams.
And we can videotape thoughts with an MRI machine. You got these voxels, yeah?
That's right. That's what Professor Gallant has done at Berkeley. He's actually given us videos. They're not that sophisticated, by the way. You might be disappointed. When you see Steve Martin's face, for example, you'll see that it is a human, two eyes, nose, and a mouth, but you can't quite identify that it's Steve Martin.
Well, this is all, you know, Brave New World stuff, but again, it's helping not only with people who have various kinds of paralysis and epilepsy. I mean, all of this is to the better in terms of humankind and solving some of the problems that have plagued us through the years and afflicted us. But some of the things just seem, you know, like talk about the Mayo Clinic looking at typing with the mind, or setting off robots with our minds, and these kind of controlling computers with our minds.
This could change the space program. It could change modern industry. These are called surrogates. A surrogate is the avatar you saw in the movie Avatar. You go into a pod, you mentally control another animal, an organism, or a robot, like in the movie Surrogates starring Bruce Willis. We can do that now. In Japan, where they make 30% of all robots, they hooked up a worker with a helmet to Asimo the robot. Asimo is one of the world's most advanced robots. He can run, walk, jump, skip, dance. He dances much better than I do. We've been on BBC specials together. He dances better than me. And you can now control him from a distance mentally. Now, think about
it. Can he figure skate as well as you, though?
No, I can't figure skate yet. That's beyond Asimo's capability. But think of an astronaut sitting in his living room controlling mentally a robot on the moon. That would give us a cheap and dirty moon base, an operating moon base controlled by mentally controlled by a worker from his living room. And that could change the face of the space program. That could reduce the cost. Or think of firefighters and emergency workers that can go right into burning buildings and not risk life and limb because you have a superhuman body. Your body is robotic, but it's controlled mentally from you watching TV in your living room.
Michio Kaku with us in studio, author of The Future of the Mind. And by the way, that was not a gratuitous reference. You have taken up figure skating.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
You weren't at Sochi, but you've taken up. Right. We're going to bring our listeners into this discussion momentarily. I just want to this is a whole new view of consciousness, really, isn't it?
That's right. We can actually see the mind actually churning away, making conscious decisions. And we now see the difference between animals and human consciousness. Animals have no conception of tomorrow. They're basically ruled by instinct. When the temperature gets cold, they hibernate.
But we're having Jeffrey Mason on later this week, and he believes animals have emotions that are just as complicated in some ways as our emotions.
I do. In fact, I ranked them numerically. I give you a new definition of consciousness in my book, such that you can numerically assign a number to the level of consciousness of people, animals, and even machines and robots.
And how do you come up with this metric?
I'm a physicist. When we look at something like a planet or a star, the first thing we do is locate its position in space, its position with regards to other stars and other planets, and then we fast forward the videotape to see how we can predict the future. So I think that consciousness is, the total number of feedback loops necessary to create a model of yourself in space with regards to other people and with regards to the future by daydreaming and by strategizing. And by this scale, even machines have a little bit of consciousness. A thermostat would have one unit of consciousness because it measures temperature. A flower would have 10. It measures sunlight, moisture, and temperature. A reptile measures its position in space. It would have maybe 100 units of consciousness. A monkey would have many, many feedback loops because it has emotions. It understands its rank in society, but have maybe several thousand units of consciousness. And we are at the top. We see the future. Our mind is a prediction machine. We can't help but predict everything. You see something. You complete the dots. You always fast forward into the future. That's what the brain does. That is human consciousness, the ability to predict the future.
And some believe there's maybe even something paranormal in that human consciousness, which can predict the future in an oracular way or in some kind of prescient way, right?
Well, I don't know about the sixth sense. I'm a physicist. We've never measured the sixth sense. However, it does mean that perhaps we can measure the intelligence of people this way. A safecracker, for example, may have low IQ, may have dropped out of grade school, but he can predict the future of a bank robbery much better than the police. So I would give him a very high ranking of consciousness because he can see the future of crime better than the police. And for me, that is the essence of intelligence, to see and predict the future.
Well, there was a book out that you probably saw called Is Google Making Us Stupider? I'm maybe flipping over the title here, but you know, the idea being somehow that we're relying too much now on search engines and Google and the like. And yet, when I read your book, I'm sort of encouraged by the idea that our memories and what we can't recall are going to become more eidetic. I mean, they're going to become literally more photographic. And with all these ideas of pills for cognition in the future and everything, I guess we're going to be smarter, aren't we? We're going to evolve in a smarter way?
Well, I've always been fascinated by super geniuses. One person had a bullet that went through the left temporal lobe. Another hit his head on the left side in a swimming pool when he dove into it by accident. Both of them became super mathematical geniuses afterwards. Now, after this interview, do not go home and get a hammer and hit yourself on the left side of your head, hoping to become a super genius. This is a very rare thing, but we've actually analyzed the brains of these people. And yeah, they have photographic
memory. This is Oliver Sacks territory, yeah.
Yeah, but we've actually now used physics to see how this mechanism works. It turns out the brain records, but the brain also erases. It turns out that memories do not fade away, like we usually thought. You have to actually erase the memory. That mechanism apparently is broken in some of these individuals. So the brain is like something that's out of control. It just tape records and tape records, but the erase button is missing. And these people say that, yeah, they can remember a day 30 years ago, 3 o'clock in the afternoon on May 2nd. They know exactly what page they were reading in a book, but it paralyzes them. They're haunted by all these memories, extraneous memories that happened 30 years ago. One woman said that she has split vision. One vision is the reality of today, and the other vision is the reality of what happened 30 years ago at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on May 2nd. And it's very disturbing. She wished it would go away.
Talking again with Michio Kaku, his new book is The Future of the Mind. Let me invite those of you listening to join this conversation. I know there are many of you who would like to weigh in here. And if you have comments or if you have questions, you are certainly welcome and invited to become part of the program. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us on the program, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. And the number to do that, 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments for our guest, Michio Kaku. And you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but you are, again, cordially invited to participate in the program. I mentioned Google. Ray Kurzweil's been on this program. He's talked about singularity and immortality. Now, if you're being prescient and futuristic, is that in the cards?
Well, I'm a good friend of Ray. We've been on TV many times together. However, I don't make definite predictions to the month or to the day when certain technologies are going to come to fruition. However, I think the overall thrust is basically correct. President Barack Obama wants to create Brain 2.0, essentially a disk with all our neural networks on it, costing about $1 billion. And the European Union is also dumping billions of dollars into this project. And if you have this disk with all your memories on it and all your dreams and hopes, and you die and the disk lives on, then in some sense, a piece of you lived on forever. And Brain 2.0 could be the natural byproduct of the Brain Initiative of the President of the United States and the European Union.
Again, there was a sense of that in the Carl Sagan novel that was made into a film, you know, about just having a disk in your head that can take you back to another period in your life.
Well, we're going to have the genome very soon, costing maybe $100. Pretty soon we'll have the connectome, another disk with all your memories and your personality quirks and the neural connections of your brain. So if you put your genome together with your connectome, bingo, what you get? You. So this has philosophical and theological implications. Is this really you? Is it like a tape recorder, a copy of you? Is the soul information? All this raises all sorts of very thorny questions.
Just like cloning did. Boy, we're in that territory, aren't we? We're talking with Michio Kaku. His new book, The Future of the Mind, and he is, of course, a theoretical physicist, and we're talking about really the next century of scientific innovation and the brain's abilities as we move ahead into the next century. You can also feel free to join us, as I said, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, and we can talk about what we're talking about, or you may have questions about Fukushima or about the movie Gravity. Lots of things up for topics of discussion. Feel free to join the program. Our email, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Michio Kaku. He's here with us in studio. His new book is called The Future of the Mind, and he talks about neurological research and how the brain resembles a corporation and fantastic inventions up ahead that will change everything. A lot of questions coming in here online and emails. Let me go to calls first, though, and we go first to Kathleen. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions, if I may. Can we program people, or can we begin to understand more about violence, about addiction, about compassion, and look at those things specifically in terms of the brain, and so that we can reduce them in the world? And number two, increase compassion and reduce the violence and addiction in the world. And number two, I know that my cat knows when my husband's coming home a lot sooner than I do. And I know that the animals, when they had that huge tsunami over in Indonesia, they ran to the hills and the humans stayed down by the waterfront. And so it seems to me a question is whether or not animals really are able to predict the future a lot easier than humans are in a different way.
Or have different sensory ways of perceiving things. It may not even have anything to do with the future. If tsunami's coming, you know, and you can measure it somehow with sensory material that humans don't have. But let's take her questions one at a time. They're good questions. Compassion, less war, less violence, those kinds of things, addictions.
When you do brain scans of the brain, you realize that Freud was not totally wrong in looking at behavior in terms of the id, the ego, the superego. If you take a look at, for example, pathological sadistic mass murderers and analyze their brains, some, not all, you can see that their pleasure center lights up when they see other people suffer. And so they actually derive pleasure, and you can actually see that with brain scans now. They actually derive pleasure from seeing the torturing of other human beings. Then the question is, what do you do with these people? Do you lock them up? Well, if they haven't committed a crime, I don't think you can lock them up. But I think that because they have such an imbalance within their brain, they are a menace to society. And if they do commit a crime and they say that it's not their fault, it's their brain's fault, I think we should still lock them up.
Well, we could theoretically reprogram them, couldn't you?
We can't do that yet.
I'm talking futuristic.
Well, we don't know how to reprogram the mind in that sense yet. Well, we're at the point where we can understand how memories are formed. We can even upload now the first memories, at least in animals now, but we don't know how to reconfigure the functioning of personality. So when you take a look at people who are violent, you see that sometimes the prefrontal cortex, that is the so-called ego, does not check the impulses coming from the pleasure center and from the amygdala, which controls emotions. So you can see why some people tend to be violent, but it's not foolproof. It's not a 100% predictor. So you can't lock up somebody for this kind of behavior. Now, behavior modification is very, very tricky. It's been tried for ever since the Bible was around. And we have had marginal success in this. That's why we have a prison system. So my book does not go into how to modify behavior. The CIA, of course, has tried for many a decade to modify behavior. All that money spent on MKUltra was basically a bust, funding psychics, funding psychiatrists and physicists to alter people's behavior during the Cold War. And so I think altering behavior is much further down the line.
Well, she also asked about animals being able to foretell or at least discern natural disasters and what can we tie into that in terms of human behavior, consciousness?
The Chinese take very seriously the idea that animals may respond to earthquakes before humans. They actually say that they should look for animals acting strange before an earthquake, because some of the biggest earthquakes of all time hit China. However, other people tend to discount this, but it hasn't been proven or disproven yet whether or not animals may pick up, for example, stresses building up deep in the earth, which release high-frequency sounds that are picked up by animals. However, animals do have a different consciousness than us. Doing brain scans of them, you see that a dog, for example, lives in a world of smells, not a world of sight. And if a cat comes up and purrs and rubs its fur next to you, it's not because it's affectionate. It's basically saying, I own this human. This human is mine. This is my territory. And I'm putting a hormone marking the limits of my territory. So cats are not necessarily affectionate. And cats are not necessarily psychic when it comes to earthquakes.
And here I thought this cat that comes to greet me every morning was just pleased to see me.
No, he's just claiming you as part of his territory.
It's all territorial. Let me thank Kathleen for her call. And I've been thinking about privacy issues, and Cass wants to go there. Cass, hi. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It seems like given enough time, science fiction becomes reality, and this is wonderful stuff, but Do you have any concerns about what might happen when we're all online all the time on the brain net, where everything we're thinking is available to whoever is kind of in control of the infrastructure? That's my first question. My second one dovetails with the last caller a little bit. You say that behavior modification is far off into the future, but how far off is it really before, the communication or the link is two ways? And does that present any ethical concerns of kind of mind control or, fooling people by augmenting their realities in ways that serves, somebody else, for example?
Well, privacy is a concern. However, we shouldn't get paranoid over this. No one's going to be reading your mind from a distance. The scientists who, quote, read people's minds so they can type and operate robots have to put chips either directly on top of the brain or very close to it in a helmet. From a distance, electromagnetic radiation damps very rapidly until it becomes part of the overall noise. So no one is going to read your mind from a distance. So you can rest assured that's not going to happen anytime soon. And the other question is, when everyone's on the brain net and kids on Facebook can send emotions and feelings and stuff like that, then, of course, we have to be careful. Look at teenagers already. They're sending pictures, naked pictures of themselves on the internet. And then when they apply for a job 10 years later, it comes back to haunt them. So a new etiquette will gradually emerge. And this means, for example, that when we go to the movies, we'll no longer see a flat screen with and hear sounds. We'll have total immersion entertainment, the ability to actually feel and experience what the person is seeing in the movies. But then, if the memory is too realistic, then criminals could take advantage of this and implant false movies, false memories into your mind. We remember the former governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, in Total Recall, where his entire marriage, his entire history was fake and uploaded into his mind. And so, yeah, we do have to pass laws to regulate this. It doesn't exist yet. But if it does exist, then laws will have to be passed to regulate it so that we know the difference between fake memories that never occurred, like a vacation, and real memories.
And let me thank Cass for the call and go to this online question from Angela, who says, can Dr. Kaku talk about how long the trace of memories might persist after death? Would it be possible at some future time to extract memories of murder victims?
Possibly, yes. But however, you have to do it while they're still alive. Once a person is dead, then entropy sets in. The neurons collapse, they decay, they start to fall apart. So when a person is alive, then you can begin the process of doing what is called the connectome, getting like a genomic map. It's a connection map of the mind. And this would be helpful not just for the criminal justice system, but realize that many people in jail are actually mentally ill. Many of them are schizophrenic. When you go outside and see homeless people talking to themselves, that's classic schizophrenia. But now we can scan their brains, and we find that when you talk to yourself, the left part of your brain lights up. That's how you generate voices. But we're aware that we generate voices. These people, however, when they have schizophrenic episodes, are unaware of the fact that they are generating voices in their own head. They are literally talking to themselves without their permission. And if that happened to any of us, we'd think, oh, my God, we're going mad. Talking to ourselves without our permission, that is what schizophrenia is.
Again, the author of The Future of the Mind, theoretical physicist Michio Kaku, with us in studio. We'll go to some more online questions, then we'll go to more of your calls. Michael writes, I was wondering if we can implant memories. Does that mean we can also implant learning so I can learn French or Japanese while sleeping or learn how to program in mere minutes?
This is one of the positive implications of this. Think of all the unemployed who get thrown out of work because technology replaces their job. They have to retrain, but retraining is a very painful process. In the future, it might be possible to literally upload memories so that you can retrain yourself for certain kinds of skills for the technological age. Or, for that matter, remember all the courses we flunked when we were in college? Here's a second chance perhaps that we can upload that material into our mind. Now remember, we can't do this yet. This is still in the future. But the very fact that we can now even talk about uploading memories into the mind, which has already been achieved, is something right out of science fiction.
Another listener writes, from this skeptical physicist's point of view, these tech-near certainties are less speculative than string brain theory, which is still a little deficient in falsifiable objective correlates. I like pretty math as much as the next man, probably much more, actually, but beauty is a great end in itself, but no guarantor of reality. See the useful and elegance of much fluid dynamics or of vertex functions. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Pretty math is not enough. The bottom line is it has to agree with the reality of what we see. That's why we built the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland. That's our baby. Our baby produced the Higgs boson just last year, and physicists won the Nobel Prize for that. But we think that's the first step. The Higgs boson is nothing but the lowest energy state of the, the last energy state of the Standard Model. But the Standard Model is the ugliest theory ever proposed in the history of science. 36 quarks, 23 parameters, 3 generations of subatomic particles. It's a mess. It's a theory that only a mother could love. Now, we think that this mess called the Standard Model, which got the Nobel Prize, this mess is nothing but the lowest octave of a string. And the next octave is dark matter, and that the universe is a symphony of strings. And I prefer this picture because one day we will test it. One day we will create dark matter in the laboratory. And dark matter, we think, is nothing but the next octave of a vibrating string. The universe is a symphony of strings. And the mind of God that Albert Einstein wrote about eloquently for the last 30 years of his life, the mind of God is cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace. That is what I do for a living. That's
my
day job.
Can you really prove string theory, though? There's no, actually bring it to bear in terms of some kind of empirical. It's hypothetical, isn't it?
We will create dark matter in the laboratory one day. And when that happens, then we realize that the Standard Model, of which the Higgs boson is nothing but the last member, is nothing but the lowest state of a much larger system called string theory. So I think string theory is definitely testable. Even parallel universes are testable. We will one day launch LISA into orbit. It is a gravity wave satellite detector, and it will pick up vibrations from the instant of the Big Bang, allowing us to retrace radiation to before the Big Bang, and therefore verify whether or not our universe is connected with an umbilical cord to a mother universe.
Here's a listener who says, when we have the capability of connecting the mind to the internet, will we also have thought crime?
Well, it's possible. Again, the human mind is quite adventurous and opportunistic, and criminals will definitely try to find some way to milk it for what it's worth. Remember, the internet itself was constructed as a military weapon, and think of all the criminals now that are using it to extract profits by identity theft and stuff like that. And remember, when you talk about identity, our identity is basically our memories. If you can tamper with our memories, then you can tamper with who you are. And so I think this technology will have to be regulated once it starts to mature.
Here's Larry. Larry, join us. You're on forum. Good morning.
Hi, how are you? I have another question came up for me from following from another caller. I'd like to ask that first and then quickly the second question. The first one is, you're talking about downloading memory to maybe learn a language. And I love playing guitar, and I would love to play like Wes Montgomery, and that's muscle memory. Is that something you perceive as being downloadable in the future?
Muscle memory is more difficult. We talked about uploading figure skating. It turns out that when you look at the memory of athletics, not only does it involve the hippocampus, it also involves the brainstem and in part the spinal cord. So muscle memory is not really memory in the muscle. It is memory in the nervous system, but not all of it is in the hippocampus, which is the organ of memory at the very center of the brain. All the research done on creating a brain pacemaker for Alzheimer's patients, all that research concentrates on this tiny little hippocampus. But as you correctly pointed out, some things like playing the piano, guitar, or figure skating would require memories that are outside the hippocampus, that require coordinating muscles. That may be more difficult. But, first things first. First, we have to code the memories of the hippocampus. But eventually, we may have to go to other brain structures and create artificial replacements for them, especially for those people who have memory problems.
And I thank you, Larry, for the call. There are a couple of dovetailing questions about music here. Mike writes, musicians such as I have intense inner playbacks of music we have heard and, in a sense, recorded. This also occurs, though rarely, in dreams. Any advances on electrodes or MRIs detecting or playing back these with audio equipment?
You mean dreams?
I guess he's talking about just music playback that plays back in the head that you hear in your...
That is conceivable. You see, the visual cortex is in the back of your head, and a lot of that is being now worked out at Berkeley and other places so that we can photograph thoughts and photograph dreams. Now, auditory signals and voices come from the left part of the brain, the left temporal lobe. And so, in principle, you could actually then photograph a piece of music, photograph a song, because the song would resonate inside the left temporal lobe, and we can simply record the impulses that circulate in the left temporal lobe, and then have another computer program that can decipher it and create music. So in some way, it may be possible one day to create a device which will actually sing on the basis of melodies that you hear. Now, many times musicians have melodies circulating in their head, and they don't have pencil and paper. They don't have pencil and paper to write down the melody. In the future, you may simply be able to record it directly from the mind rather than using the bars and the treble clef and the notes of music.
Well, here's another question along those lines. Susan writes, if our memories may be available for storage and future access, will we have the capability to upload other people's memories and capabilities? For example, will we be able to play the piano taken from other people's memories?
Well, assuming that we can solve the problem of muscle memory, in principle, the answer is yes. Now, remember, every brain is different. However, we think that certain things cut across brains, and therefore we think that memory in one can be used to guide the memory of another. For example, just yesterday, and remember, every day a new breakthrough is being made, just yesterday, at Harvard University, it was announced that they can take two monkeys, have the impulses from one monkey energize and control the spinal cord of another monkey. And so this is an avatar. And so we are now making advances so rapidly that every day we're beginning to understand how memories are formed, how we can decode these memories, and how these memories in turn can be placed into another person.
Here's another caller. Stephen, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. You're on the air.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
You know, I'm actually kind of an appreciator or student of Dr. Rudolf Steiner of the 19th, 20th century turnaround. And one thing that he talks about is a warning to civilization is this advanced technology and science, which is very inspiring and beautiful in a lot of ways, yet it has to be balanced, if not tempered, with the emotional maturity of the population that it's being exposed to. Has anybody ever actually shown any concern about that?
Well, I think you raise a very valid point. Albert Einstein would always say that our technological abilities have overreached our ethical ability to control the technology. And one day it could lead to disaster. Now, so far, we've averted a disaster with regards to nuclear war, for example, but it's not because we consciously said, let us disarm and let us build a nuclear-free world, right? And so we have to be very clear that governments will try to use some technologies for their own ends. Now, in the book, I have a chapter on MKUltra. MKUltra was a top-secret project of the government and the CIA to control people's minds. It investigated all sorts of cockamamie schemes.
This was all of that stuff where they were trying to move objects by telekinesis, too. In fact,
that's right. Yeah. Telekinesis, mind reading, hypnosis, LSD, recruiting scientists and physicists to find Soviet submarines underneath the ocean. All sorts of bizarre stuff. Now, I'm a physicist, and when I read these documents, I realize that almost all of them violate the laws of physics. But there's the CIA with no understanding of physics, spending taxpayers' money. Why? Because they believed Russia was doing it. During the Korean War, when they saw American GIs denounce U.S. imperialism during the Korean War, it freaked out the CIA. The CIA thought, oh, my God, the Russians can control American minds. And that set them off on this 20-year journey into psychics and paranormal and LSD and hypnotism, all of which amounted to nothing. Absolutely.
Well, there was,
nothing.
During the Cold War, there was all that. In fact, what was that famous movie again that was with Frank Sinatra?
Manchurian Candidate.
Manchurian Candidate, yeah. There was this idea that, you know, there was mind control and the Russians had mind control. Here's a comment from a listener named Ryan who says, of course, the negative aspects of brain manipulation will make political ideology just another upload. The revolution in the social sciences will be profound. Let me give you a couple of critical comments here just to get your response
sure.
to these. Matt writes, Professor Kaku simply bypasses the debate on Descartes' ghost in the machine question and the question of mind-body duality, claiming that feedback loops, obviously based in mechanistic algorithms, are somehow the final word. Then he comes back to the latter and says there are lots of questions about whether DNA-based replicants would truly have the same sense of you as the new replicant would. He seems inconsistent in terms of questioning the philosophical underpinnings of mind-body duality. Here's another comment. Says, odd to have a master of the cosmos opine on mind. He is rather reductionist. Consciousness is fundamentally a crystallization of the entire brain, every region resonating with all others and experience genetic diathesis, developmental accretions. There will never be a region like the libido or superego, which we can upload memories into. Seeing a region light up is not the whole story of a thought or sense of self.
Well, the answer is yes. I agree. I agree with both comments. Now, let me explain. It's true that a long time ago, people thought the soul was different from the tissue, wetware, that creates the mind. Recently, neurologists say, no, the mind and the brain are really the same thing. The mind is software, the brain is wetware. It's the same thing. However, now we're beginning to go back to the dualism Descartes, because now we can separate consciousness from the mind, just like in Star Trek and just like in all these other science fiction movies when we encounter pure consciousness in an alien being. If you have the connectome, which is the end product of President Barack Obama's brain initiative, it means that in some sense consciousness, all the neural networks, the mind, the emotions, are encoded on a disk separate from the mind which created it. Just like the genome exists independent of the body, the connectome will exist independent of the brain.
Mind and consciousness being separate.
Yeah. So in some sense, we're going back to Descartes, that the mind and the body really in some sense are different. They can be separated, and maybe one can live forever even after the body decays. Now, the other person says you have to look at the brain holistically. I totally agree. But if you have certain thoughts go through the brain, like a guilty thought, a pleasurable thought, you do see certain specific parts of the brain light up. That doesn't mean that the whole brain is not aware of it or is activated by it or responds to it. But thoughts are localized in that sense. It's staring at you in the face. You look at it and you say, it's holistic. But there it is. Certain definite parts of the brain, clusters of neurons light up like a Christmas tree when certain behaviors are enacted. So you have to see the whole picture. Yes, the brain is holistic. Yes, the brain is aware of everything happening in the brain on some level. But yes, certain areas of the brain have localized activity, and we can create a map. In fact, in my book, I even show you what this map looks like. We can create a map of the human brain.
So Cartesian stuff is really back in, and you're cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am. Yeah.
That's right. In some bizarre sense, Descartes is coming back, and Freud is coming back too. After decades of poo-pooing Freud, we can actually see the superego and the id and the ego at work.
Superego is kind of like a policeman with a club, I think, isn't it?
And it's located right behind your eyes. Yeah. Right behind your eyes is the orbital frontal cortex, which is your superego, which says, you shouldn't do that.
It's Jiminy Cricket. And here's Nick as our next caller. Hi, Nick.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. You know, I have a quick question. For obvious reasons, I've never really went into this with too many people, but when I was a child, I had three dreams. Didn't make too much sense, but they all came true about 30 years later in life. I also had an experience one time where I was having a dream. I woke my ex-wife up, and the dream was pretty scary. I was up really, really tall, what I thought was maybe like an extremely high tree or something that was on fire, and people kept jumping off of it. So I went to work that day, and the next thing you know, I found out the Twin Towers were under attack. So I don't know what that is, if premonitions or whatever you want to call it, but I've always been curious about, is there a place to go study this?
Excuse me, but you know, you were talking about Freud before, and he, of course, said dreams are the royal road to the unconscious, but there are those who believe dreams can be premonitory, and there's a lot of research that's come out of Harvard that says dreams are just kind of a spilling out of all sorts of neuron activity. They don't mean anything.
Well, the truth, I think, lies in between, because when you talk to people who actively study dreams with MRI scans now, you realize that much of the lore is actually true. Lucid dreaming, the ability to consciously control a dream, we prove that that actually exists in Max Planck Institute in West Germany. You can actually control the direction of a dream. And in fact, in my book, I even explain basically how you can control the course of your dreams as shown by MRI scans now. Now, it turns out that when you MRI scan someone who's dreaming, the prefrontal cortex, that is the ego, is turned off. The orbital frontal cortex behind your eyes is turned off. And that's why dreams go into outer space and fantasy. All the fact checkers, all rationality is thrown out the window. So what lights up when you dream? What lights up when you dream is your amygdala, which controls emotions and fear. That's why on the main, most dreams are a little bit unpleasant, a little bit scary, because it's the amygdala, which controls fear, which lights up.
But Freud thought it was all a matter of repressed wishing. When he worked with these soldiers, these Austrian soldiers, for example, and they're having terrible nightmares, he said it was a way of wishing that they could reconstruct and get back whatever trauma they had went through.
There could be some grain of truth. The amygdala is not that far from the hippocampus and the nucleus accumbens. In other words, the pleasure center. And so there is a line of thought which says that fear and tension is what drives many dreams, because they light up in the dreaming brain on an MRI scan. And they, in turn, have tension about what? What do people have tension about? Usually it's tension about your friends and your relatives and about sex. And so perhaps Freud wasn't totally wrong, even though I think that a lot of his theories are bunk. We now see that the essence, the skeleton of Freudian psychology has some truth, even when it is applied to dreams.
Well, it's a fascinating book and well worth a read. Michio Kaku's The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. And good to have you back with us on Forum. Appreciate your being with us.
Great. And the book is now number one on Barnes & Noble's list.
Well, congratulations on that score. Again, Michio Kaku is Chair and Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College of New York. And I'm sorry I couldn't get to a lot of your questions, but you can continue this discussion online. You can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and continue talking about mind and consciousness and all the rest of the things that we took up. We're going to take up the Academy Awards in the next hour and find out what your thoughts are on who won and who lost and who should have won and was it worth watching when we return on Forum. Forum is with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. And Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.